Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Adventure is Dr. Kathy Sullivan's motto. The former astronaut has the distinction of being the first U.S. woman to walk in space. That happened in 1984 on her first of three space shuttle missions. Trained as a geologist, she also participated in a number of oceanographic missions that studied the ocean floor.
Sullivan also served from 2014 to 2017 as the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and she's the author of the new children's picture book, To the Stars, the first American woman to walk in space. Sullivan will be in Milwaukee tomorrow giving talks at elementary schools and the Dean's Distinguished Lecture at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in the evening. We caught up with her at her home and asked her how she tailors her talks to the various groups that she addresses.
You know, with all audiences in one way or another, I try to work in some insights or some reflections on key events, key experiences through which I would trace the line that connected me from a little girl in Southern California to someone wearing a spacesuit outside the spacecraft. And again, with a young audience, you know, you can look around a grade school classroom and kind of spot the kid that's maybe getting in the same kind of trouble you used to get in at that grade, or having the same question in their mind that you used to have there. And it's very fun to try to put a question to the audience or answer one of their questions in a way that opens their eyes to the fact that I wasn't any different than them at that age. And there's nothing that should stop them from dreaming about the boldest goal they might have in their mind at that moment. And then, you know, finding out how close to that goal they can get with good hard work and some good fortune.
So as you were that little girl in Southern California looking up, I think a lot of us did that. Certainly a lot of us who grew up in the 60s where the space race was going on and all kinds of exciting things were happening. Did you have it in your mind even at that early age that I'm going to be one of those people up there?
You know, I did not. I had no real formed thought about what I was going to be when I was growing up. I do think we tend to ask little boys, even to this day, more pointedly, what do you want to be when you grow up? And we tend to ask little girls, what do you like? And so maybe it was just that, but it was not an issue or quest in my mind to come up with a job title. I certainly watched all those guys avidly, and my father was an aerospace engineer, so you know, that added a bit to it, but this was clearly also something coming from within me. You know, it's worth remembering at the same time, back in those early 60s, all the weekly and monthly magazines that would show up in your mailbox back then, Life magazine and Look magazine and National Geographic, almost every one of those would have both some story about these new creatures called astronauts and the amazing things they were doing. And side by side at that time, there were also comparably dramatic stories of the adventures of deep sea explorers that from Jacques Cousteau to many others, that were opening up the frontiers of scuba diving and exploring the deeps and imagining undersea villages where people would live someday. So I had both of these grand adventures playing out in front of me on a daily and weekly basis, and some of them on television. And what I remember vividly feeling and thinking about was how incredibly cool it was that some people had that kind of adventure in their everyday life. It was the work they did. You know, my dad put on a tie and drove down the road somewhere and came home 8 hours later. That didn't look very adventurous. He was a design engineer. I now realize it was much more stimulating than I could appreciate at the time. But these, you know, visibly grand adventures, seeing the world in a different way, in the case of the oceanographers, traveling to exotic places and exploring the deeps, that really resonated with me. And as far as I took it at those early years, through about high school years, I actually would say, was just sort of holding it as, a kind of an urge or a thought or a hope of, I wonder if my life could have that kind of adventure in it someday. It was clearly a hunger and a real sort of yearning, but through at least the end of high school, it was, nothing was helping me crystallize it into any kind of game plan. It was just a seeking, you know, seeking that kind of adventure.
Yeah, I absolutely get it. I avidly watched the Jacques Cousteau things, too, and, you know, wanted to be up in space when Star Trek happened. You know, I was like come get me, I will go.
Yeah.
But you got a lot.
There.
Yeah, you got a lot closer. You got a lot closer than I did. But at that time, too, there weren't a lot of women's faces in those pictures. So, you know, you had to extrapolate a little beyond, you know, what you were looking at in those magazines and what was on television, because there weren't a lot of women who were doing that kind of exploration.
Yeah, that's true. And it may be one of the reasons that I've always bristled at the current notion of role modeling, which often is captured as, if I can't see it, I can't be it. Look, no human being would ever have done anything first if that was true, right? If you always really had to see someone else who looked just like you do it. I understand the kind of extra inspiration that can come from being able to see someone that you can identify with, the sort of confirmation of, oh yeah, someone who is just like me, visibly just like me, can do this. Okay, I get that. But there were not people who looked just like me doing it. And I didn't, again, I would attribute this to my parents' approach to individuality and the way they were raising us. I didn't see this as men or white men are doing this, and therefore there's some implication that I can't. I saw this as people, human beings, expressing and pursuing the urge to explore and understand that is native to every human being. And I never accepted or even thought for a moment that because that person doesn't look like me, I can't take a lesson from them about courage, or I can't take a lesson from them about perseverance, or I can't take a lesson from them about hard work and intelligence. I can look at a man and try to take any lesson I want from him about fatherhood. That's not going to help me a lot. But short of motherhood and fatherhood and a few other things, the qualities of these people that I was watching were about adventurousness and courage and intellect and curiosity. And it absolutely never crossed my mind that none of that was pertinent to me unless it was being done by someone who looked exactly like me.
Which I suppose is part of the adventurousness too. You just go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was kind of an ethos in our family. I think my parents were very fine parents, but they were spectacular co-discoverers and co-learners. Asking and answering questions together was sort of a favorite sport in the family. If we encountered a problem or saw something interesting, the common way my folks would engage with it was, well, isn't that interesting? Let's see, how could we figure that out? You know, they helped us learn how to use the mental muscles of encountering something new, making some initial sense of it, thinking what that might mean, experimenting, exploring, probing it, and, you know, finding your way forward to some insight or some knowledge or some workable or workable enough solution to a problem. And, you know, not being intimidated about having a question that you didn't yet have an answer to, and not thinking that, you know, if you didn't have a snap answer at the tip of your tongue, you had failed. You build answers, you figure things out. Nobody knows everything at every instant. That's the fun of being a scientist or an engineer, is you're tackling things and answering, building answers to questions no one else has really figured out a way to answer yet.
I was going to say, you're coming up with the actual questions, too, sometimes, I think. And that's almost as important as the answers.
Always honor a great question even more than you honor an accurate answer.
Now, when you talk to elementary school kids today and you're, you know, explaining, you're talking as passionately to them as you are to me right now about your process and how you learned, do you find that the kids respond? We're in such a different world now where answers are readily available through Google, you know, and everyone's got a phone. Are kids just as curious?
Oh, I think they're absolutely as curious. I would agree with the sort of the point you're heading to, that the, in my opinion, rather too often and starting at rather too young an age, the method they get exposed to for coming up with an answer is go find it instead of let's think about it. And that's probably not developing the same really robust, you know, cognitive and creative skills that the think about it challenge would do. Now, you know, a 7-year-old thinking about certain questions is likely going to reason their way forward to a less sophisticated sounding answer than what they might find written on some page on the web. But they will, you know, they will have grown in a different way by reasoning than just by looking it up and trying to remember it.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it allows them the chance to come up with their own questions too.
Yes. Look, a question asked and answered is a, you know, it's like, you know, bouncing a ping pong ball back and forth across the table once or twice. A question asked and thought about and reasoned about almost inevitably leads you to recognize or appreciate more nuance and facets to the question than just finding the answer, you know, finding an answer that gets you the grade, finding the answer that makes some adult happy. You always find other offshoots to an interesting question. New questions are just new dimensions of it that you didn't think were there when you first posed the simple sounding question.
So I know you probably get asked this all the time, but stepping out into space that first time, what did that feel like?
Well, it's more like swimming than stepping, for one thing, because around the space shuttle when it's in orbit or the International Space Station, you're not moving with your feet. You're moving yourself around really with your hands. You only use your feet if you need to settle somewhere and do some work, push a wrench or something like that. Then you want to be able to anchor your feet in some pedestal that lets you use all the big muscles of your body to deal with the forces of that. But otherwise, you're swimming is the closest thing to it, and scuba diving and underwater training is the primary way you get accustomed to moving in that way. So, you know, you're floating out, not stepping out. And it's a fabulously free feeling of movement. And of course, quite a coveted and very special experience to be looking at the Earth sliding by beneath you with, you know, no window frame. It's really, you know, you looking at the Earth straight out. And that's pretty spectacular stuff.
Yeah. And then I would think turning and looking out into the blackness of space is also another amazing thing that we don't get to see really from here.
Well, it might be, but two things. Number one, it was always Earth that fascinated me. So any little bits of spare moments I had, I was looking at the Earth, not looking outward. And secondly, you know, at the altitudes that space shuttles and space stations fly, you're above the clouds and the atmosphere, and you're away from all the city lights and things that can make it hard to see the heavens, but you're not really meaningfully closer to any of them. So to me, they never looked all that wildly, radically different. The biggest difference to me was in the course of a few days, heck, in the course of a couple of minutes, you could see constellations in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, which, of course, as an Earthling, you need to spend something between hours and days going from one latitude to another to see that. That was pretty special, you know, to see the Big Dipper and the North Star and the Southern Cross in the span of a couple of minutes is impossible except in a spaceship. But the stars and constellations and even the Milky Way, to me, they felt a lot like ways I had seen them backpacking in some high mountains away from all the lights on a really fabulous clear night. Whereas to see the Earth the way we were seeing it, with the sun rising and setting every 45 minutes, with a continent at your glance outside the window anywhere you looked, seeing the aurora and the air glow there, and you can see the dynamics of our atmosphere on these remarkable scales, you know, that is such a wildly different way to see the Earth that was way more fascinating to me. But that's over and above the fact that the chance to see the Earth from space with my own eyes was the deepest reason that I even applied to be an astronaut. That's really what the sweet spot was to me. You know, the hardware, the equipment, the operations certainly had a fascination, but why would I want to give up being an oceanographer and apply to be an astronaut? The simple bottom line reason was if by some quirk of fate they accept me, I'll get to actually see the Earth with my own eyes from that vantage point instead of looking at some other astronaut's pictures or watching movies. The right experience is worth more than just the image.
If we had the technology figured out to get to Mars, would you go?
In a heartbeat. I'm a geologist by original training. How can you not want to see those volcanoes and those spectacular etched plains? And yep, I'd go.
How close do you think we are?
Oh, I Sadly, I don't think we are very close, more for reasons of political will and financial vision than technology. There certainly are some technical hurdles to be overcome, and there's certainly some human health and safety hurdles having to do with radiation and prolonged exposure to zero gravity. But, you know, if a country was serious enough about it and saw any kind of strategic purpose in it, boost a bunch of technologies, really jumpstart a plethora of sciences. I mean, the number of frontiers and science disciplines in which you'd really have to make giant strides forward to pull that off would be numerous. And the benefits that would flow over time to life here on Earth from all of those giant strides would be huge, just as the cascade of benefits that flowed into life here on Earth from the Apollo program and the early space program, that cascade of benefits was huge. No one was targeting, make everyday life better. They were targeting, put people on the moon, bring them back safe, sound, do it within a decade. And the array of problems they had to tackle, new things they had to learn, new abilities they had to create was so wide and so rich and so deep that it has spilled over into our life for decades afterwards. And I'm absolutely confident the same would happen again, if not in even greater fashion, if you just mount it as a big, bold push to go to Mars, and then, as I like to say, set the goal and don't blink. It's going to be hard. It will be slow. There will be setbacks. Don't blink. Don't second guess. Don't start and stop. You know, set it and go. Push through. Persevere. Accept there will be risk and accept there will be setbacks. But the paybacks, I believe, would be tremendous over a long period of time.
Again, questions we haven't even thought of.
Precisely.
Well, Dr. Kathy Sullivan, we are so looking forward to having you speak here in Milwaukee. I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Kathy Sullivan is a scientist, former astronaut, and explorer. The former NOAA administrator will be in Milwaukee tomorrow to speak at area elementary schools and will give the Dean's Distinguished Lecturer at UW-Milwaukee. Her talk there is sold out, but there's more information at WUWM.com.
Let you work.